This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 15, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, physicist and author of the book Synchronicity, F. David Peet, as well as a trialogue with professor and author of several books, including Turbulent Mirror, Dr. John Briggs. Joining me this week as co-host is musician and generalist Alex Fulton. This episode, we tend to converge on the interplay between process physics, a la David Bohm, and the creative process. More often than not, there is an over-compartmentalization of microphysical principles from the workings of the mental world. But if we take seriously the concept of as above, so below, and are aware of cutting-edge research into the nature of consciousness, there are undoubtedly strange fractal similarities between these two worlds of human endeavor. By understanding these connections, I think it becomes not only easier to understand each subject matter on its own terms, but also reveals the fundamental ground that unites all such subjects emerging from the collective unconscious. Thanks again to my guest this week, and thank you for listening. Joining me today on Pentimental is F. David Peet. David has a PhD in physics and has authored or co-authored several books, including Turbulent Mirror, Synchronicity, as well as Science, Order, and Creativity, to name only some. He was also a longtime collaborator and biographer of physicist David Bohm, who is best known for his work in solid-state physics on top of his speculations on what he termed the implicate order. So thanks for being with me, David.
Well, it's good to be talking to you.
So just again, maybe you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit more in detail, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, well, I did theoretical physics. I was at a place called the National Research Council of Canada in Canada doing theoretical work. And I got a bit bored and I wrote round to people saying, who's doing the most interesting work at the moment? I want to do something new. They told me Roger Penrose, who at that time was at University of London. Oh, he was Stephen Hawking's supervisor. So I spent some time with Penrose. And I thought one day he was in the maths department. I'll go across to the physics department, went into the student room, and there was an older man talking to a young student. And the student says, there is no absolute. Very firm about that. So the older man said, oh, is that an absolute statement? So I followed the older man down the car and said, I've got to talk to you. He said, come to my office tomorrow. My name's David Bohm. So we went, and for several days we talked about physics ideas. And then at the second week, I suddenly phoned him and said, I thought we were talking about physics. He said, aren't we? I said, no, we're talking about the nature of consciousness. He said, come and see me tomorrow. So that was it. And we continued, and I knew him for several years. We interacted together. We wrote a book together, and we were working on a second book when he had heart problems and he began to suffer from depression. So we were not able to finish the book, and he died in 92, but it was a very interesting relationship with Bohm. He would come out every year to a place called the Bailey Farms Institute, which is near Ossining, New York, and the two of us would spend a few weeks together just talking, exploring ideas. It was a great relationship with Bohm.
Maybe if you wouldn't mind, can you maybe outline David Bohm's hidden variable theory of quantum physics as opposed to the several other interpretations? I guess the predominant one is the Copenhagen interpretation.
Yes, that is the dominant one. Well, Bohm was with Oppenheimer's group out in California, and then when he finished, he went to Princeton, and at Princeton, he took a room in the house next door to Einstein. So he and Einstein became very close, and he would go, you know, go to many evenings. Einstein had a lot of German expatriates playing musical instruments, giving concerts, and he would spend time with Einstein, and Einstein looked at him as a sort of spiritual or intellectual son. And at that time, Bohm decided to write a standard textbook on quantum theory. He wrote the textbook, and he tried to be as honest as possible to what was called the Copenhagen interpretation. So this was when quantum theory was created. Niels Bohr was at Copenhagen, and he would call in Heisenberg for discussions, and then Schrödinger, and the two of them. Heisenberg created his theory of quantum theory. Then a year later, Schrödinger came along with an alternative, and Bohr tried to put the two together and made one interpretation called the Copenhagen interpretation. So Bohm tried to be as honest as possible to explain that. When the book came out, he began to have doubts, and he thought maybe they oversimplified. Maybe there were genuine differences of approach between Bohr and Heisenberg, and rather than allowing them just to debate, to be there in the open, to cause more investigation, Bohr had sort of closed the door on it. So Bohm felt he wanted to look deeper. And so he did, and he came up with an alternative interpretation called hidden variables, in which the electron just isn't totally probabilistic, but has an actual path. And he felt, you know, this is going to cause incredible controversy when it comes out. It'll cause a debate, and he was excited about the debate, because he felt that was what was really needed, was to open the door to the meaning of quantum theory. And in fact, at that point, he was in Brazil when his paper came out, and to his shock, there was very little reaction. He could not understand it. There was just silence, and he was deeply shocked by that. Maybe I should tell you what had happened beyond that, was that when he was with Oppenheimer's group, there were quite a few people interested in what they called the Russian experiment, what was going on in Russia, and Bohm was one of them. And then later on, these people were suspected of maybe having communist sympathies. So Bohm was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was asked to name names, but he refused to give names, and was then later arrested for contempt of Congress, went for trial, was acquitted, but at that point he could find no employment in the United States and was forced to go to Brazil. While he was in Brazil, his paper came out, and Oppenheimer called a conference of leading physicists to discuss Bohm's paper and find what is the flaw, what is the error in the argument. At the end of the meeting, Oppenheimer said, "We cannot find an error in Bohm. We must all agree to ignore him." And that was the story that went out, ignore Bohm. And later on, you know, when I got interested in Bohm, and I would mention this to older physicists, you know, quite reputable physicists, they would tell me, "Oh, Bohm's theory is wrong." I'd say, "Well, that's really interesting. Can we look at the paper? You explain to me where the error is." "Oh, well, I've never read the paper. I just know it's wrong." So that was it. Bohm was wrong, and that was quite a blow to him, that his work was ignored, and I think it left him feeling very low, till he ended up later on in Bristol, and he went in a new direction.
And David Bohm's hidden variable theory, which is the theory of the quantum potential or the implicate order, actually was a offshoot of the pilot wave theory of Louis de Broglie, right?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And in fact, the interesting thing was when he was in Brazil, the only person who really responded to him was de Broglie, and he sent his assistant to Brazil to work with Bohm. Maybe I should say a little bit more about the hidden variable theory, that in fact, Bohm had sort of put it to one side. He was, you know, depressed about it, hurt about it. He put it to one side. And many years later, he had a student when he was at London University. And the student, this is incredible. Imagine this happening today. The student goes to the bank and says, "Can I use your computer at night? I want to do some calculations." And the bank says, "Oh, sure, you know, come in at night, use our computer." So he went into the bank at night. He didn't use it to round off figures on check, but actually to do calculations based on Bohm's early hidden variable theory. And he used a computer to do this and was able to calculate the actual orbits of the electrons. And when Bohm saw that result, he was like amazed. That was the dream he'd had, and there they were. These were the electrons that the actual paths causal paths of the electrons. And so he then developed the theory a little more, added to it, and came up what was known as the quantum potential. Now, a potential is a thing, that we all in everyday physics, we have sort of things like magnetic forces. If you have magnets pulling on a piece of metal, or electrical forces. So you have magnetic potentials, you have electrical potentials. Bohm added a third one he called the quantum potential. Now, in the case of a magnet, the effect the magnet has depends upon the strength of the force. But in the case of the quantum potential, it doesn't depend on the strength. It depends on the shape of the force, on its shape, or you could say it's on its form. So Bohm says this is information. What it is in this quantum potential carries information about the electron surroundings. So it carries information about the electron surroundings, and the electron can respond to that. In other words, the electron can read the information in the quantum potential. So at this point, Bohm says, well, this implies that the electron has proto-mind. The mind isn't just something that evolved, as animals became more complex, but it was there from the beginning. A sort of proto-mind was there from the very beginning. And another physicist who had maybe, could say, thinking on parallel lines, was Wolfgang Pauli, who believed that mind wasn't just something that came much later in this history of evolution, but had always been present. So that was it. He developed, at the end of his life, he developed his inferable theory even more and introduced the quantum potential.
Maybe we can just quickly spell out the difference between causal and acausal, because the Copenhagen most interpretations accepts the idea that electrons or whatever don't actually have fixed paths, that they just jump from A to B, that there's nothing in between. But Bohm's theory, in combination with the experimental findings of Bell's theorem, possibly implicates that it's a non-local field. There's something non-local about it, which is bizarre. So, but at the same time, there's still a movement, and he called that the hollow movement. So can you kind of differentiate those two?
Yeah. The hollow movement would be the movement of the whole. So it is in a sense, has a causal side to it. It's not completely probabilistic. It's not completely causal. But he did want almost a more deterministic approach to the quantum theory. And this was at the base. And then finally, his explanation was it's the quantum potential, this field of information about the surrounds of the electrons, which is influencing the path of the electron. And the electron is able to read this information and respond to it. And so it has a causal path. It isn't completely probabilistic.
And what's fascinating is that if Bell's theorem is correct, which it seems to be, and it should reorganize our conceptions of how the universe works and maybe even how we fit in these quote-unquote paranormal events or synchronicities or psi effects or these sorts of things. But at the same time, it harkens back a bit to Whitehead too, right? Which is life is a process or the universe is a process or things are more like biology, right?
Yes, it's interesting. Whitehead's book, Process and Reality, it was something that Bohm read as a young man. He was quite interested in Whitehead. He was very keen on Whitehead. But later on, when I knew Bohm and he talked about the hollow movement, talked about movement, talked about the flowing movement, the real mode, and I mentioned using the word process, and he sort of objected to that. No, he didn't like the word process. And that was a sort of, you could say, a little bit of an idiosyncrasy about Bohm, that he didn't always want to expose his early influences. And I think Whitehead was one of them. He kept quiet about Whitehead, but people who knew Bohm said, no, Whitehead was quite an influence on Bohm with his book, Process and Reality.
And I guess in reading your books, at least where David Bohm comes up, the question of was he trying to return determinism to physics comes up, because he seems to be stereotyped as, oh, he's trying to be a naive realist, or he's trying to put determinism back into a theory where determinism doesn't exist. But I think you did a good job of spelling out his exact... It's hard because it's a fine line. It's almost like a chaos type perspective where there's determinism and indeterminism at the same time. But is there a better way to spell that out?
Well, also, I think the other part about Bohm was I mentioned what I referred to as the real mode. The idea of the quantum world is a world of eternal flux and change and process. And that he felt that the world around us that we see, the table, the chair, are well-defined objects in space and time. And this for Bohm was, we take that as be the hard and fast reality, you know, bang on the table, you feel your knuckles hurt, it makes a sound, that's reality. But for Bohm, that was a sort of surface reality. And beyond that lay something much deeper, that the chair and the table, all those things were manifestations of an underlying process or an underlying movement was constantly unfolding and enfolding. So this is leads to things that we call the implicate order. But the world around us is a sort of surface world, and there's a much deeper reality underneath. And that was the one he wanted to get to. And part of what he felt was the barrier is our language that we speak, a European family of languages. We say the cat chases the mouse. So we have a very well-defined object in space and time, a cat. We have another well-defined object, a mouse. And we have something operating between them, chasing. So it's very much like a Newtonian worldview where you have well-defined objects in space and time interacting by fields and forces. So we felt that our Indo-European languages, English, French, German, all those languages really reinforce a Newtonian worldview that the banging on the table is a hard and fast reality. But underneath it is a deeper order, which he called the implicate order, an order of movement and flux. And so he proposed, could we change or could we develop an alternative language, a language that is very rich in verbs, in which nouns, objects are less important, but verbs are the important things. And that was what he worked on in his spare time. And he called it the Rio mode or the flowing mode. And then the last year of his life, I organized a meeting in Canada, in North America, and it had some native elders there. One of them was Leroy Little Bear, who explained about the Blackfoot language, that the Blackfoot language is a language incredibly rich in verbs, and their worldview is one of eternal flux and process. So that for Bohm was quite a shock. He was staggered by that, that he'd finally met a group of people, a culture that saw the world as he saw it, as flux and change, eternal process, and their language reflected that. For them, you know, it was very difficult to divide the world into categories like we do, you know, categories of fish and trees and things like that. No, no categories, just flux and change. So that for him was quite a revelation to see the world that he felt was closer to the quantum world, a world of flux and change and process, in which the surface world is a sort of outer manifestation and is not the deeper reality. And just in passing, I could say that I've noticed the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick has a very similar philosophy to David Bohm's. Several of his novels, and as you know, so many of his novels got made into films, but in so many of his novels, we just see that the world in which a person lives is a sort of surface world. There's something much deeper, a deeper reality beyond that, a sort of hidden reality. And that makes itself very attractive to because the world of films. And there's a couple of Philip K. Dick, well certainly one of his stories, you have the actors, the whole thing is filmed with actors, but then it's animated over the actors. So what you do is you see animation, but you recognize the faces and the figures and the voices as being well-known actors. And so what you see is a surface reality, but beyond that is a deeper reality. And that, I think, is a nice complement to Bohm's approach.
Yeah, I think that was a Scanner Darkly.
That's right, yeah, Scanner Darkly, yeah.
And another science fiction writer and philosopher that I found drew heavily off Bohm was Robert Anton Wilson, who Robert Anton Wilson also developed this idea of E-prime, I think in parallel with the Rio mode, which again is just writing without using is. So It's constantly trying to use verbs and everything is process and everything is open to question. And I thought that was such an amazing thing that Bohm brought to the conversation was his motivation was, hey, let's keep things on the table because the moment you shut the door, creativity sort of gets extinguished.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And you actually wrote a book with him called Creativity, Science, and Order.
Science, Order, and Creativity, yeah, we worked on that together. That was an interesting process. I could maybe tell you a little bit about that. I would take the underground out to Edgware, where he lived, and arrive there in the morning. We'd go for a very long walk. He loved to walk. In Who's Who, he listed his hobby as walking. So we go for a long walk and talk during the walk, come back, have lunch, then he'd have a rest in the afternoon, and I would then write out the notes of the conversation, and then we'd go over, the next day we'd go over them, have another walk, another talk, and that's gradually how the book evolved. I would do the writing in the sense of reporting our conversation, and then we would edit it together. So the book was created through a long series of walks in North London, and then when the book was completed and we decided to work on another book, which was going to be called The Order Between and Beyond, and there we were meeting near Ossining, at the Bailey Farms Institute, and we had other walks to start working on the book. But unfortunately, his depression sort of came and he was prevented. You know, we were unable to complete writing that book, but I did have a lot of notes. I just mentioned about the walks. It's very interesting, the walks. I remember generally you walked in the direction coming up from central London. You walked in the direction of Euston Station, then you turned right and went to his office at University of London. I remember one day walking with him, we're talking in detail. We ended up at Euston Station. He says, "Where are we?" I said, "Well, this is Euston Station." "Well, what are we doing here?" I said, "I thought we were going to your office, but you didn't turn right." He looked all bewildered. Another time we're at the Bailey Farms. We take this long walk and we're walking, we're talking, we keep on walking. And he said, "Oh, that house looks familiar." I said, "Yes, we've been past it twice, Dave. We're walking in a circle." So I think when he walked, he had no idea what he was doing. He was just walking.
And in reading a little Castaneda, there's always the emphasis on movement and almost walking or just being out in nature, and being in that process is a spiritual practice in and of itself. If you are present in the moment and are focused on it, you kind of just flow with it. So it's interesting, and it seems only natural that the best ideas would come out during those sorts of episodes or those long walks.
Yes, he liked very much being in nature and being surrounded by trees, a lake, a stream. Yeah, that was very important to him, the natural world. Yeah, very attracted to that.
For me, a core emphasis in that book was this idea that, yes, there is this sort of mechanistic side to man, and at times we are just ruled by our animal instincts and whatnot, and reflexes, but at the same time, there does seem to be this capacity for inspiration or creativity or imagination that then breaks the old patterns and reorganizes us into a new attractor space or a new mode of living or being or thinking. And that seemed to be a big part of his dialogues and also that book.
Well, yeah, I don't quite know, but I could mention the second book. It was called The Order Between and Beyond. And the idea was we looked at different positions as Romanticism and Classicism, the various positions that there are. And then his idea was, in our thinking, at times we tend to form a fixed position, you know, in our mind, in our thinking, where we cling to a particular idea. And on the other side of that fence is maybe an opposing idea. And so is there an order between the two of them? That's what we began to look at. What is the order between the two? Between, say, quantum theory and classical theory, between Romanticism and Classicism, what is the order between? And so we were working on that. We were talking about that. And it so happened that we did this at this place called the Bailey Farms, which was organized by a lawyer who was involved in conflict resolution. So this is a lawyer when two people have a dispute and they would like to go to court and, you know, pay a lot of money to pay for lawyers. Well, the alternative is that the court will get them to maybe sit down together and come to some resolution, find some order between. So we saw that, and then we began to think, well, maybe the order between involves making compromises. You know, I'll give a little bit away, you give a bit away, we'll meet in the middle. Can we transcend that, which is something Bohm always wanted to do, to transcend, to go beyond? Can we go to the order beyond? So that was what we were working on in, you know, in the last times we met. What is the order beyond? What will take us beyond? And that was our plan for the book, to move from the order between, which can resolve things, can get us out of uncomfortable situations, but maybe involves a little compromise. Can we go beyond that, transcend it to the order beyond? And that was what we were working on. But unfortunately, you know, Bohm's heart problems, his high blood pressure, he had a heart transplant and he wasn't well. He was also suffering a little bit. He had had a series of depression. It was over, but he still felt the taint of the depression on him. And so we were really unable to complete that book, which is unfortunate, but I did keep a whole series of notes. And when a new edition of Science, Order, and Creativity came out, I wrote a new final chapter, which contains some of the insights. But I still have my notes from our discussions, and they were very valuable. And it was unfortunate that we were unable to complete the book. I should also mention, we discussed Whitehead. Another big influence on Bohm was Hegel. And one of our last discussions, the very last time we met and we walked at the Bailey Farms, was on Hegel. Bohm kept returning to Hegel as something that impressed him from way back. You see, when he was a student with Oppenheimer and they talked about the Russian experiment, they knew about Karl Marx. And what was said in those days, that Marx had put Hegel on his feet. And then Bohm finally discovered Hegel and read Hegel, the original, and said, no, Marx stood Hegel on his head. So Bohm was very impressed with Hegel. And that was our last conversation we had, was on Hegel.
Yeah, and Bohm was more willing to discuss what metaphysics really meant and its value to scientific method and scientific discourse and this process of questioning, which is so valuable and so much in science now, whether the new dogmas, string theory or multiverse or whatever, or the Big Bang, it has to be this way. It's this way. And there's no other theories that are even allowed to be considered credible just because there's a dogma at the time. So it's a dangerous, almost totalitarian idea to just settle on something and shut everything else out.
Yeah, you raise a point there. And this point, I think, is that I remember in the 80s and 90s, you know, I was following what was going on in physics. We had string theory, then superstrings. And then it became, this is the theory of everything. This is going to result that physics is going to come to an end, that we have ultimate theory, explain everything. And there was a lot of excitement about that, a lot of people working on it. I remember looking at the statistics and an alternative in that period, I mentioned that I went to work with Roger Penrose, and Penrose had his own approach. But there may be only five people in the world working on Penrose's approaches, and all the rest, tens of thousands, are working on superstrings. But then the theory of everything really didn't ultimately materialize into a single all-embracing theory. Part of my feeling is that's why there's been a revival of interest in Bohm. The people who said, okay, we put all our bets on superstring theory, on the theory of everything, but it didn't work out. What else is there around? And I think Bohm's work has always been highly controversial, but I think there's been an expression of interest now. Maybe he was onto something. So we organized a conference. I'm speaking from a little village in Italy, a Pari, Hilltop Village, and some years ago I organized a conference on the legacy of David Bohm. Since then, there have been other conferences, several conferences. So there's been a revival of interest in Bohm's ideas. People are beginning to look at them again. And I think partly it is because this wonderful theory of everything, which would be the end of physics, never quite worked out. So let's have a look and see if anybody else had an idea. And I think maybe that's why there's been a revival of interest in Bohm, although he still is considered controversial. But people are beginning to look at his theory. At the moment on the internet, there's an incredible exchange of strong emails of people are looking at Bohm's approach in a controversial way, saying, no, physicists don't believe in it. Other people say, no, they don't understand it. And you know, that it's going on at this very moment as we speak. You know, five or six emails are being, or Facebook or wherever, are being posted daily.
Yeah, and Bohm is refreshing me because, yeah, again, there's this idea. People want to believe that we're reaching the end of knowledge and we're finally going to figure everything else, what it means to be human. And I find that totally delusional. And Bohm always said that, well, we can find out stuff about the universe and it's a constant unfolding. We're always finding out new stuff if we approach stuff with an open mind and creativity. But at the same time, there's always going to be mystery. There's always going to be some new puzzle to solve. And that is sort of the process of life itself and part of being human. So I think his analogy was you aim for the impossible, which is trying to leap a cliff that you'll never leap, or trying to find the ultimate theory of everything. But in trying to brainstorm a way to get there, you come up with all sorts of interesting, you discover all these hidden orders that you didn't know were there to begin with.
Yeah, yes, he was always a very creative person and with quite an open mind. Yeah, yeah. It was very good to spend time with him.
I guess just jumping back to the hidden variable theory a bit, and this idea of the electron as sort of a proto-mind, because I find that fascinating, and it's almost, it reminds me of two things, which is panpsychism, and also the concept that these things at very small scale, as the electron and proton, the dogma is that, well, they all behave the same in our experiments, so they all must be identical, or they must all be very simple little billiard balls, or in the case of quantum physics, they're smeared out objects. But anyway, they don't have any structure, or they're not sophisticated objects, and they're not capable of perception or what have you. But if this information potential has some reality to it, that raises that question again. And that seems to be, I don't know, so many scientists seem to be afraid of the idea of consciousness entering the equation again in a meaningful or sacred sort of way, not to attach religion to it, but they always feel like it's some sort of Trojan horse and they have to defend poor humanity about falling into irrationality again or something.
Yeah, but also to remember that for Bohm, everything is a process. So that little electron isn't a little tiny ball flying around, but is a manifestation of some deep underlying process of the whole universe, which is manifesting itself and unmanifesting. It's constantly folding and unfolding. The universe is folding and unfolding into the electron. So the electron is a manifestation of something much deeper.
And that's already in line a bit with quantum field theory, where particles are considered, or quanta are considered, just vibrations and fields, right?
Yeah.
So it links up quite nicely, and it also, it's a still an underdeveloped field and not too many people investigate it, but this idea of quantum chaos, that's very Bohmian. And maybe that's a transition into your other work, which is on chaos theory generally, or you touched on that in the early to mid 90s or the 80s, I'm forgetting which, with John Briggs. You wrote a couple books on the subject.
Yeah, John and I wrote, yeah, I was interested in that whole approach of chaos.
Yeah, what was it about chaos theory for you that was so interesting?
Oh God, it would be hard to think back, but it was a new approach, and I was interested in it. And I don't want to go into that too much now, but it's a sort of a little bit in the past. Yeah, but it was interesting. But I think for Bohm, he was a bit allergic to chaos and chance. He didn't feel that the universe was ultimately chaotic. There would have to be a hidden order always. So for him, he would reject that idea that there must be somewhere a hidden order. There must be an order somewhere. We can't just break down into total acausal chaos. There has to be a hidden order.
And again, you mentioned Roger Penrose, and I'm always fascinated with his work. I don't think he goes as far with some of his ideas as he could, but he has two really interesting ideas. One of those you mentioned was that alternative to string theory, which is, I believe, spinner theory or spinner theory. I'm forgetting how you pronounce it.
Twister theory.
Yeah.
Twisters, yeah.
Maybe talk about that maybe just a touch. And also this idea, he's designed the Orc OR of quantum fluctuations as a source of consciousness in the human mind. That's another interesting idea that he developed in Shadows of the Mind.
Yeah.
So would you be willing to talk a little bit about either of those?
Well, the idea was that when you look at quantum theory, there's a thing called spin. The electron has spin. It's not actually a spinning particle. It's just mathematically, it looks like a thing that spins. It can have two values for spin, plus spin up and spin down. And if you put a bunch of electrons together, a very large number, they sort of form a sort of space. And if you bring, so you have two electron spaces, you bring them together, and what they look like is they define an angle, a Euclidean angle, an angle between them. So in a sense, if you have you have these electron particles, you know, you bring them together in a mass, and you bring a second group together, and they define an angle in space, a Euclidean angle. So somehow, some aspect of space is being created out of these electrons. So Bohm wanted to go a little bit further, and rather than spinners, he generalized that and discovered that what he could do, he could define both angles and Euclidean spaces. So he could make space out of groups of electrons. So that was his idea, that somehow space can be created out of these quantum particles. And that was his twister theory that he was working on. But the interesting thing was, I was with him when he was working on that, and there were just a few students working. One of them worked in a bank, of all things. A couple of them were at university, but he had a small following, but it was considered to be, you know, a genuine possible alternative to the big ultimate theory of everything. This was Penrose's work. So I think it was interesting. And then he did The Emperor's New Mind, he was questioning the whole idea of things like artificial intelligence and what is the nature of consciousness. He's a very creative person, but he was always sort of a little bit on his own. He was originally at University of London, then at Oxford, but he didn't have the big following that because he wasn't in doing the mainstream series of everything other people were doing. But I found him very creative and amazing to go to his seminars and see this guy sitting at the blackboard with his back to the blackboard, piece of chalk in his hand and reaching out and writing down equations. I am as amazed at that. He wrote down these equations behind him. He didn't have to turn around and look at the blackboard. He just wrote down all these mathematical equations. Gave these incredible seminars. It was a very creative thing. On a Monday, we'd go out and then we'd buy a cup of coffee and continue. That was a very creative time for me to spend time with Penrose. Then, of course, his student was Stephen Hawking. I was deeply distinguished by being asked to take Stephen Hawking to the bathroom. I don't think it's worth the Nobel Prize, but it's partway there.
You know, I know they were together. I didn't know Hawking was his student. And that's a little surprising because Hawking doesn't seem to be much for... He's an imaginative fellow and a great physicist, but at the same time, he's very hard-line about certain ideas. And I never got that impression from Penrose that he was hard-line about anything.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't quite know what their relationship was. But of course, Hawking had to do a PhD. He'd have to go through a supervisor and, take the formalities to get his doctorate. He was an amazing, amazing mind, incredible mind. Let me just divert a minute. We've had these two movies came out. That one we just mentioned, Theory of Everything. And then another movie is The Imitation Game about decoding the Enigma code. Mm-hmm. So two exceptional movies about exceptional minds. And I have been working with a producer in Ireland, Paul Howard, on the idea of making a documentary film on David Bohm. And recently people have said, wait a minute, why are you making a documentary? Why don't you make a feature film, a movie about Bohm, a fictional movie about David Bohm? And maybe have Benedict Cumberbatch playing Bohm, which would really be something else. So that was something that's just been flown out maybe in the last weeks. No, you don't make a documentary film. Make a movie on Bohm, on Bohm's life. And which could be interesting because there's a bit of drama in it. There's the being arrested, contempt of Congress, rejected by Oppenheimer, having to flee the country, ending up in Brazil. It could be interesting. A movie on Bohm. What do you think?
Yeah. So is that, I know the documentary has been entertained for a while. And I think, right, as far as a story goes or a narrative goes, it's as good as fiction for sure. And he went through so many tribulations and these ideas, like you said, there's a revival of them. And if we're reaching a dead end with the standard model and string theory and just how to understand the universe, period, I really do think that eventually Bohm and Whitehead and De Broglie and these sorts of folks who were entertaining these other sorts of hidden variable or process driven ideas will ultimately have their day. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime because inertia is so slow nowadays with academia and institutions and what have you. But when we get there, I think there needs to be some sort of recounting or retelling, whether that's a documentary or a movie. And obviously there's books, but still not enough of them, and they're not largely recognized. So I think it's a fascinating idea and definitely worth people's attention just to either get momentum behind it or just to pay attention to the period. It's a good idea.
Well, that would be great. I don't know if it'll ever work out, but certainly we do want to make a documentary on Bohm. If we can get the funding, if we can get, somebody's television company to want to sponsor it, or some individuals will put up the money to make a documentary. Let me joke about this. I keep saying, look, we've got to make this before everybody's dead. When we first, because Bohm's contemporaries, they're getting on in years and they're not going to be around forever. So let's make it while we can still interview them.
Right, exactly. And as far as people that are carrying on these ideas, I mean, there's not many, but someone I like is Lee Smolin. He's written a number of books and wrote the best critiques of string theory out there. And he has his own hidden variable theory, which is a bit more abstract, but it's a bit like Penrose's, where it's very much a relativistic or a relational concept where the objects themselves are creating space-time as we understand it. And so it's an interesting approach, and at least someone else is still trying to go there because a lot of people are kind of fed up with just beating our head against the wall and saying, well, we have 500 to the 12th string theories and all of them give us an answer we want. So it's not even science anymore.
Yeah.
Not that we can't have a new definition of science, because I don't agree with the Karl Popper definition that it's all experimental. But at the same time, it's like if you settle on string theory, which is largely metaphysical now, because math is, when it gets that abstract, it is getting metaphysical and totally detached from reality. You know, it's silly to say this is the truth. How will you ever prove that? No one can. So we have to open the doors to new ideas again and get more momentum behind like a diversity of approaches.
Yeah, you know, I get emails from people and, you know, occasionally the people write to me, you know, I'm taking a look at Bohms and trying to take a new approach. Very young people who are sort of deciding they'd like to take another look. It's encouraging.
It absolutely is. But I mean, I guess investigating the foundations of quantum theory doesn't pay the bills. You know, you have to get tenured. You have to do this sort of stuff. And Basil Hiley, who's also a collaborator of David Bohm and collaborator of yourself, in the interviews I've heard of him, he recounted that story himself where he was interested in these ideas as a young student. He was told not to read Louis de Broglie, these sorts of things. And for a time, he put it aside because he had to pay the bills. He had to get his teaching credentials, all these things. And only later in life has he been allowed to kind of return to them and really emphasize them again as important. And so I think it's unfortunate that people are censored almost within these environments, which is odd because we would think of academia as very open-minded, but a lot of times it's not.
Well, let me just tell you something. Basil Hiley was in the physics department at Birkbeck, and it had quite a reputation, that physics department, for exceptional work. It's been closed. University of London closed that physics department, replaced it with the School of Football Management. So Basil was out of an office. He wandered around that building, and he found an empty office. Somebody was on sabbatical and has been occupying that office and doing his important work there. And occasionally the head of the department will look through the door and say, oh, you're still here. So that's it. He's not being given an enormous office with a great desk and something on the door. He's just borrowing someone's space. So that is the sad thing of what's going on in universities. And the other area which this happens, philosophy departments. You know, the Minister of Education in England, the previous one said, I don't object to philosophy, but the state shouldn't be paying for it. So that's it. You know, you can do philosophy if you want, but don't expect the state to pay for a chair of philosophy.
I just find that very dangerous because philosophy at its heart is about questioning. And so if we just say, oh, there's no use to questioning, what's going on there? I mean, humans are what sets us apart. Not it gives us any right to do anything unethical to nature, but we're highly symbolic creatures. We have this vast scope of imagination, and it's almost, I think, a travesty not to promote that and to say, oh, there's nothing left to question, that we always think we've reached the end of the universe, the end of knowledge, just like Hawking, who was saying in 1985, oh, we're gonna, you know, science is gonna end any time now, just like Lord Kelvin was saying that at the end of the 19th century. And history just keeps repeating itself. It's fascinating that these quote unquote super intelligent men just keep repeating the same mistakes. And so I'm starting to not give as much credit to, oh, that's a really smart guy. I always ask, well, what is he tempering his intelligence with? Is it dogma or is it an open-mindedness? And that's a really important question.
Yeah, I think added to that is a critique of how physics is being, you know, picking on physics, how it's being done, how departments are run. Is it really allowing for creativity to flourish? Or is it just on getting results?
And right.
A lot of critique going of how things are being run.
Well, for me, this is a hangover from like the 50s emphasis on, you know, the particle accelerators and building the bomb and all this sort of high energy physics, which is just getting data. And we've reached the end of data. I mean, we have the Large Hadron Collider, which is giving us nothing anymore. And it's just, as far as I'm concerned, a pointless enterprise now because we can't explore the levels of theoretical physics that they want to. It's not revealing anything new. And instead of trying to come up with new approaches, we just keep throwing more money into these mega projects that yield harsh diminishing returns at best and nothing at worst. So I think there has to be new ways to go about that.
Yeah. You know, I remember I used to go to the Fetzer Institute, and that was an interesting place. And they funded this meeting we had with Native Americans and Western scientists, and who were strongly supportive of David Bohm. And I made a suggestion to them, why don't you ask the top physicists, or the top, don't have to be physicists, top scientists, whatever, top philosophers, ask them, who is doing the most interesting and creative work you know? A young person, who is doing the most interesting work? And give that person money. What you do now is you apply for a grant. And, what does that mean? Well, you apply to a granting agency for money. So if you're in the States, when, say, at the meeting of American Physical Association, when there's that meeting, you have a couple of friends you put in the audience and you say, you give them key questions to ask you. So you pretend you don't know them, and this person asks a question. You say, oh, that is really interesting. You should ask that, because, in fact, I've been working on that and I've got these results. And the idea is that people from the granting agency sit in the audience and say, oh, this person's on the ball. Another thing that I've been told has happened, and I've known cases of this, is where you propose, you've done a piece of research, say maybe experimental research, you have your results, and then what you do is you make a proposal to do those experiments. You give them the grant, and you write in reporting your results, but you've already done them. So there are various ways in which you can cheat, in which you can get funding, and just to keep going. And the alternative I proposed, and nobody took me up on it, was just find out who are the amongst young people are doing the most creative work, and just give them some money. Say, go ahead and do it. I think that would be interesting if you just gave them a bit of funding and say, go ahead, do what you want to do, rather than having to make all these proposals and, go through that mill of trying to get granting. So it's not very creative the way funding is done.
Yeah, and something else Lee Smolin brings up is, well, a lot of young students, they have to kind of pay homage to their advisors or whoever, because, and within institutions, we don't get a lot of creativity because people get promoted who, people that do the promoting and the people that do pass on credentials, they like to promote or support people that reflect themselves. And so we're just perpetuating these old ideas from the 50s, the 40s, sometimes earlier, that because we've reached the point of diminishing returns with that method, we're just beating our head against the wall and pretending like we're making progress. And that's a very dangerous thing. And I guess just to sharply change direction with the little time we have left, it's just interesting. We mentioned Pauly a little bit, and we've talked about him significantly in when you were on Always Record, but Pauly was the first one to actually denounce not Bohm's hidden variable theory, because I think he actually was the only one that wrote to David Bohm and said, hey, I like what you're doing here. But in 1927, when it was first proposed by de Broglie, he was the one that said, this is wrong because of this. And in hindsight, Pauly was wrong. But it's just interesting, that connection. So you have Pauly, who was the first one that set it back. He was the last one to kind of support it, or the only one to support it when it came back. And also, you've also written on synchronicity significantly, and there's these connections between Pauly, the implicate order, and synchronicity that I just find fascinating. So there's all this, the story, how it all added up ultimately is fascinating to me. And I guess, did Bohm's ideas lead you to synchronicity, or was that something on your mind? And then if we have the theory to account for synchronicity, why do you think it sort of transcends our usual explanations of just chance occurrence or the usual ways that synchronicity is dismissed by the large proportion of people is just a statistical phenomenon?
Well, what happened was I was watching television one time, and there was a series of interviews from the BBC called Face to Face. One of them was an interview with Carl Jung, and I watched that. I was fascinated by it. And the year I took off to go to England, and I mentioned initially to work with Penrose and then with Bohm, I was staying in a residence, and they had a big library. So I spent a lot of my time reading Carl Jung, and that roused my interest in Jung and synchronicity. And then I became fascinated by Wolfgang Pauly. I mean, Pauly was an amazing man. He was brilliant. He did his incredible work as a young. When he was at high school, he published his first scientific paper on the theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. And then his mother committed suicide, and he had a serious breakdown. He began drinking heavily, and went to see Carl Jung, and he wasn't treated by Jung, but by another therapist. But then he developed this relationship with Jung and pushed Jung into synchronicity. and got him, in fact, to write about synchronicity. But the rest of his life was divided between his public work in theoretical physics and his private work on seeing, you know, an integration of matter and psyche. And it's interesting that towards the end of his life, he suddenly abandoned this. He gave it up and then shortly afterwards died, was in hospital and died. And I was just struck by the parallels between Bohm's, you know, very free work and then being hit by depression at the end of his life, and Pauli also abandoning everything towards the end of his life. I just wondered, what was the connection between the two men who were so creative and so open, and then towards the end of their lives, closing down?
Well, what convinced you, besides just the fact that, you know, you have these guys with a lot of credentials and good thinking processes supporting the idea, what for you, in looking at synchronicity, how come it transcends our usual explanations that anything that can happen does? Why does it transcend that for you?
I don't know, just the experiences of synchronicity and reading about it, hearing other people's accounts of it. I was fascinated by it. It's a connecting principle, which isn't causal. It transcends the normal, you know, everyday causality of the modern world and, well, the classical world is both. And I was very interested in synchronicity and the fact that, you know, when I wrote the book, okay, I get two sorts of responses from my book, Synchronicity. One of them is, this is amazing. I was reading a novel and I looked up and I was in a taxi and I looked up and saw the name of the taxi driver. And it was the same name as the person who wrote the novel. And I think, oh, so what? You know, big deal. So what? Most of them are like that responses. But then I do get other responses from people where they have genuinely something has happened. Something transcendent has happened of a synchronicity, something beyond any explanation. Those are the deep ones. They're interesting, those synchronicities.
And I guess tied into that, maybe this is the last thing we can touch on just real quick to revisit this idea of information and the information potential. And Bohm's concept of information as opposed to mainstream information theory, which was originally started with Claude Shannon and had to do with signals, telephone signals and what have you, but it's evolved to this sort of metaphysical or theoretical physics framework. But Bohm was talking about it in a sense that, right, you mentioned it earlier, that it's not a force, that it's similar to, say, a boat picking up radar or something, that the distance and there could be these subtle effects at a distance or non-local effects that seem to be magical or there's nothing between them, but in fact, they're just these highly subtle organizing principles at work. So what does he mean by information? Can you spell it out a little better?
It was more this idea that there could be a field that is very subtle. It is a very weak energy. It's not pushing or pulling anything, but it's very rich in information. And that would be the similar thing as, you know, you mentioned this, that there's a ship approaching a harbor and it has very powerful engines that push it through the water. But it also has a radar dish that picks up very, very low energy, very subtle signals, but these signals are very rich in information about the coastline. And so that rich information goes into the computer and steers the ship. So this subtle information is able to direct the very powerful engines of the ship. So that was the idea, you know, in the same, applying this in the quantum theory, that there's some subtle information, a field of subtle information that can then give form to what is happening at the quantum level. So it's two ideas. There's a gross information, the gross energy, and then the subtle energy.
So when the electron reaches the double slits, it is picking up the signals of where the other electron went before it, right? And then it adjusts its path.
Yeah. It's picking up information about the slits, about the environments of where the other electron is, and it's responding to that.
Is it fair to say that these particles then, can we think of them as organisms, or do you think it's a whole different beast, or just there's hints of it enough where we can tether biology and physics together in a more meaningful way?
I don't know if you can talk about them as organisms, but certainly Bohm would like this idea of what he referred to as proto-mind, something that is to some extent mental, but exists before minds exist. So it's a sort of proto-mind that responds to a field of information.
Okay, David, so we're over an hour now, so why don't we try to wrap it up a little bit. We talked about the movie that's at least a conception and something that you hope could be done sooner than later. So that's one thing on the horizon. Is there anything else that you're working on? Are you doing more workshops in Italy, or what's your general schedule like?
Oh, yeah, you know, well, we're running a few things, and this year has been rather, you know, we cut down a little bit, but we're running a couple of things. One bizarre thing is a group of medical doctors, Italian medical doctors, who are interested in the treatment of chronic pain. And we're going to have 25 of them here in Pari, looking at the role of hypnotism in dealing with chronic pain. So, you know, that's bizarre. That's nothing to do with quantum theory or hidden variables, but, you know, that's... So, but well, then we'll be running some courses next year. But, you know, we're selective, and I run things. I teach at California Institute of Integral Studies in California. I don't go there physically, but I teach online, and I have quite a few PhD students I'm supervising there. And, you know, I teach one or two courses a year on via the internet. So I'm pretty active in that respect. I don't know if I have another book planned, but you never know. There's another book around the corner.
Well, have you thought about finishing any thoughts on the real mode or anything like that?
That's, you know, there's certain things, you know, you could say on the shelf waiting for me to address them. And yeah, I don't know about the real mode. Yeah, it's maybe something to, I've got a few ideas and maybe I'll work on something else, but I don't know at the moment. The moment the weather is so awful, it's cold, it's maybe leaving me a bit depressed. I want a nice lot of sun and hot days.
So, yeah, David, thank you so much for making time for me today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com. Thank you.